This episode of the Partially Examined Life is brought to you by St. John's College Graduate Institute, offering discussion-based master's degree programs for Western liberal arts or Eastern classics. Go to partiallyexaminedlife.com/SJCGI for more information.
Libertarianism.org is the best resource out there to help you understand the ideas behind libertarianism. They've got podcasts, videos, essays, free books, and more. So go learn more about libertarianism as a political philosophy at libertarianism.org.
You're listening to The Partially Examined Life, a philosophy podcast by some folks who at one point set on doing philosophy for a living, but then thought better of it. Our question for episode 139 is something like, what's the relationship between sexism and racism? Or maybe, how can we mitigate the effects in our psyches of historical racism and sexism? And we read some works by Bell Hooks, Ain't I a Woman from 1981, and a little bit of Black Looks, Race and Representation from 1992. You can join the discussion, get the text, and lots more information at partiallyexaminedlife.com. This is Mark Linsenmeyer, relinquishing my role in the patriarchy in Madison, Wisconsin.
This is Seth Paskin in Austin, Texas.
This is Dylan Casey in Middleton, Wisconsin.
This is Maisha Cherry in Chicago, Illinois.
Welcome, guest Maisha.
Welcome.
Whom folks might have heard on her podcast, Unmute.
Yes, the Unmute podcast.
Tell us about that for a minute.
Yeah, it's a podcast that seeks to kind of bring philosophy out of the academy and to talk about issues that affect the real world. And so I've had the opportunity to interview lots of junior scholars and a few senior scholars to talk about real life issues.
Just like when we talk about Hegel's logic, it's real life issues.
The beginning of that is all about us, but the real life issues we're not always so good on.
Currently, I am a PhD student in the philosophy department at University of Illinois, Chicago. And prior to coming to the University of Illinois, I was adjunct in the New York City area teaching philosophy. Before doing that, I was working in the nonprofit sector. And so I've always kind of been passionate for disenfranchised communities, quote unquote, the marginalized and the oppressed. And so I felt as I transitioned from the nonprofit world to academia, it wasn't an attempt to kind of turn my back on those particular communities, but to still work with them in a very different way. So as much as I am very into academia and philosophical research, I'm also very interested in public philosophy. So I've been writing for the Huffington Post for the last 5 years or so. I've also done a lot of op-ed pieces for Salon.com and the LA Times, and written a few public pieces for public philosophy books. My philosophical interest is in social and political philosophy. And so the podcast, the focus of the podcast is to kind of talk about those kind of social and political issues. We've had in the last year and a half or so, we have a podcast coming out very soon on pornography. We talked about slurs. We talked about propaganda. We talked about ignorance. And so I interview a particular philosopher and we talk about one particular topic throughout the podcast. So I found that it's been a way to bring what they write, which is perhaps very academic, to a public audience. It's been a great companion pieces in classrooms and also for people who've never heard of their work before.
Yeah, I just listened to the one on slurs yesterday. So just so the other people on here know, we white people are not allowed to say the N word. That's what I learned from that slurs piece. Not even lovingly. Can't even quote it.
I'm looking forward to what you're going to learn about pornography, which is our next episode.
Well, we have a lot to learn. So
I'll leave that there.
Well, Bell Hooks has a lot to say about that. Not necessarily in just what we read, although, so Ain't I a Woman is, for the most part, a historical overview. I mean, that's a quote from Sojourner Truth, who, what is the exact date that she was famous?
1852? Does that sound right?
Yeah, so there's something about the 19th century black female political awareness that she thinks is more radical than is today within feminism or among black women generally, and wants to focus in this book. She just felt like going and looking. She wrote this as an undergraduate, apparently.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. She wrote, it was,
wow.
The first draft was done when she was 19.
Way to make me feel bad about my work.
Okay. Now, it wasn't published until about a decade later. So I'm guessing from all of the quotes and historical sources and stuff that are thrown out in here that she kept working on it, that it wasn't like it was done at that time, but she initiated it. She did a lot of, you know, she felt like as an undergrad, I can just go out and do this.
She was looking for a publisher, apparently.
Uh-huh.
Shortly after her undergrad. So
part of the reason why she wrote this is because she's a voracious reader and was looking in the library, like, where are books about Black women, about the experiences of Black women? And she just wasn't finding them. And at least according to the introduction here, her significant other at the time said, well, why don't you just write one? So she set out this. So there are five chapters and each one goes through a different aspect or historical point. So chapters one and two were on sexism and the Black female slave experience, and two, a continued devaluation of Black womanhood, right, in the, what is the nice word of being freed?
Manumission.
Manumission.
That's like a high school word.
Yes, exactly. That's what I feel like I learned that at that time, and I've not heard it since. So we did not focus on those. Those did not seem, I mean, it's interesting. It's like really good cultural information to know. But in terms of like, what is there philosophically? What is there controversial? What is there that we're supposed to disagree with? Because she really likes to write books with all these ideas that will blow your mind. And this is because I've seen her talking about her own work in video recently, that she prides herself that this is part of what she does and what her readers tell her that she does. So the things that are supposed to kind of hit most home, the official assigned reading here was chapters 3 through 5, which is the imperialism of patriarchy, which is mostly about how sexist those great civil rights folks were. Yes, they were fighting against racial oppression, but when you hear them talking about, when you hear Richard Wright talking about the Negro or something, Negro men, it means Black men. And I'm just going to use Black in this conversation just because bell hooks uses it. I'm not going to say African American. Chapter 4, racism and feminism. So the same thing. These people that are revered as the old time, not Sojourner Truth, obviously, but Susan B. Anthony and folks like that, that were either racist themselves or made political compromises because they wanted to gain the support of white women in the South to their cause, so that they ignored the experience and plight of Black women. And then chapter 5, Black women in feminism, is the most like overtly political. Hey, Black women, raise your political consciousness, get involved in this. You may have dissed the whole movement in the past because they were so racist. This is their call to action. How did that work as a little summary of that? Any other additions?
I think you're making it sound like she was making an attack on these people. I think there's a broader theme. She's trying to make the point that Black women's experience during slavery and then post-slavery was completely overlooked, that there's an assumption that feminists were fighting for the rights for all women and they weren't, and that people who were working towards emancipation were not necessarily considering Black women's experience. It's a broader theme that she was saying they're victims of both sexism and racism, and each one of those worked against the other, that if they stood up to fight against sexism, they were told, no, you need to focus on racism. And if you stood up to fight against racism, it sort of erased the whole notion that they were being oppressed as women. So it's a broader theme that she uses those as examples, pointing out, for example, the suffragettes were all white women and that Black women were not included in those caucuses and were not welcome and that sort of thing.
Yeah. So part of this, I guess, an overall purpose, why should we be aware of this history? Why is she presenting it like this? It's part of this raising of historical consciousness. We're all enlightened in the modern age to then figure out how are our minds still messed up from this. So this is kind of where that second work that we read some of, this Black Looks, Race and Representation, comes in. That was published in 1992, published a decade later, and I guess written like 2 decades later. And she gives us a little more, the parts that we read of that, the introduction, which is kind of about her program of media critique of a lot of the problems of, is a hermeneutic issue. It's about the stories we tell ourselves. To have an identity is to be able to tell a story about yourself and your background and your group identifications. And as long as those are messed up, as long as those are infected with what's left over from white supremacy and
patriarchy. And capitalism.
Yes. Well, capitalism is raised a little bit, but I guess that's one interesting thing we can consider.
But that's the triplet.
Yes. And I think that's part of kind of what it comes down to, that even if you were objecting to like that the old time, or even right now, people fighting for women's liberation are, she thinks, fighting mostly, well, we want to have the good capitalist jobs like the men do. And that's not going to be the route to self-actualization. And since especially Black women being pelted on all sides by these historical injustices are in a position where they're already having to critique the whole culture. And in doing so, well, probably you should be critiquing what you want to replace it with, critiquing yourself, critiquing the new stuff. So why not reject the capitalist imperialism as well? Why not do something that's actually going to be self-actualizing?
One of the things I would have liked to hear a little bit more about, but that's clearly in there, is kind of the psychology of how oppressive cultural institutions or just ways like racism and sexism and capitalism affect the way the individuals who are oppressed see themselves, and also how they try to actualize themselves out of it. She spends a lot of time in Ain't I a Woman talking about mistaken ways of actualizing oneself that amount to basically assuming the role of an oppressor.
Right, adopting their whole framework. I don't reject the framework, I just reject my position in the framework.
Yeah, and the example to me that stood out was her discussion about the relationships between black women slaves and the white women during slavery times. The white women were oppressed in this patriarchy, but they didn't identify themselves as women in solidarity with black women, but in fact became oppressors. There's a psychology going on there from her perspective about escaping from domination. And the way to do that is not to become part of that. What did she say? I saw this talk that she did that you pointed me to, Mark. She said, not to get in the ring. That's not part of our reading, but to not be part of the competition and inevitably become an oppressor. That's what it sounds like. She doesn't develop that in what we read, but.
Well, but I did read that one of her, of the many people that she most idolizes is Eric Fromm, that we did an episode on recently, and she's written some books on love. So that kind of gives you the clue that she really keys in on Martin Luther King's view of love as the solution to all these things. So it's self-actualization and openness and just trying to get at a place where you can have real dialogue with each other and that's engaging. And so she's very, reading this made me understand a lot better. I feel like a lot of the modern, you know, what I read in Salon, but she's very positive. She's critical, but she's critical in a way that is a part of love. She was talking in that same talk about people say she hates Spike Lee. It's only because he's worth critiquing, because he has so many good qualities about his movies or something that it's worth talking about the way that he portrays women or whatever.
I'm going to say something about that self-actualization point. Yeah. As I was reading Black Look, one of the things, I mean, it does seem as if she doesn't give, I guess, a prescriptive or how to self-actualize. But one of the things she does do is, I hate to say beg, but she kind of asks those who have self-actualized themselves to kind of produce narratives.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So that people can have an account of how they did that for themselves. And so she even highlights her own life, right? And I think one of the things that I enjoy about reading Bell Hooks' books is that she does indeed write from a first-person perspective in which she's telling us about her experiences, what kind of lays out for us how she self-actualized and perhaps how we can, right? And so I think her mentioning of Angela Davis' autobiography, and even at the time, you know, begging for a feminist like June Jordan to also write these autobiographies to kind of allow Black women in particular and other people as well to see what does that self-actualize and entail and what does it look like.
Yeah, I mean, that's her call to action at the end of the revolutionary Black woman's essay in Black Looks is basically what you just said. Write some books.
It's that, but she also says it should be backed by two things, theory as well as revolutionary practice. You know, she says she still always has been a Marxist, and the idea that if your goal is to self-actualize outside of the framework, then you need to somehow overcome or get rid of the framework, which requires revolutionary action, which requires organization. One of the themes that I saw reading the second set of essays from Black Looks and reflecting back on Ain't I a Woman is that she frames the whole narrative, historical narrative of Ain't I a Woman about reactions to the capitalist, but really more colonial framework that was brought over and institutionalized. So during slavery, it's obvious terrorism and oppression. Following slavery, there's psychological terror. There's the desire to conform. So she's framing everybody in terms of them wanting to play roles that they think they're supposed to assume, and that it causes this very conflicted consciousness and self-image. And that book never sort of touches on, like you say, it just kind of ends with, you know, we've never told these stories. We've never considered this perspective, and we don't really have a theoretical framework for even acknowledging Black women as subjects. And then in Black Looks, she sort of puts a little more theoretical focus in that. But
doesn't sound like she has a prescription, because I don't think there is a prescription. Like, go do this and you will become a self-actualized person, not in response to capitalist imperialism, but rather I think she thinks there needs to be a movement of expression which will find its way as people do the things that they feel they need to do and push against the boundaries, but also simultaneously organize and collect in a way that's productive.
So, Maisha, I know you'd read a lot of stuff related to this. Just some background. So it was actually Law Ware that prompted this episode, and he was supposed to be on here, our guest from our first episode on race a while ago now, but he's been on a couple episodes since then about religion. He ended up not being able to make it tonight, but I'd been looking for an opportunity. I love having other podcasters on, and I know Maisha knew a lot about this. Had you read much Bell Hooks before diving in this time?
I think every black woman has read Bell Hooks, but that's going to be a generalization.
She's got 30 books, yeah, so there's a lot of damn levels there.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. At different points of my life, I read different kinds of books by Bell Hooks of when I'm trying to get my teaching together and trying to reimagine myself as an instructor in the classroom. I read her series of pedagogical books. And then I was doing some research on masculinity, which I'm very, very interested in. And we've read echoes of that in the reading that we read. But her book on black masculinity is just brilliant. Also, I'm very interested in political emotions, anger, to be more particular. And she's also have a book on rage. And so at different points of my life as a black woman, but also my research interests, I turn to Hooks.
Dylan or Seth, had you...
I had never read her before and just found it super interesting. First of all, she's a really good writer.
Yes.
And just from that perspective, it just was really interesting to read. And then maybe this is just a consequence of the kind of typical historical education I have. But in Ain't I a Woman, it's clear that she just read all kinds of books that were like deep, deep in the library, or deep, deep in like a library, but not in every library. And looked in particular for a lot of personal individual accounts. So it's a kind of history, a kind of genealogy, and also just a kind of reporting, like a reporting back, a reporting in the future of the past. And in that way, I found it just utterly engrossing to have someone distill these first person accounts along with the analysis that went along with them to bring it together. It made me want to read more of her books. So
I think it goes to show, I mean, she kind of mentions this in her critique of quote unquote white feminism about upper and middle class women only doing the theorizing or only presenting their experiences. And in a way, when we think about the feminist canon, you do have lots of work by white women. And I think what black feminists today is trying to recover, like white feminists were not the first feminists, right? And they were not the only feminists in the 19th and 20th century. And I'm still trying to catch up because I wasn't taught a lot of this stuff in high school and undergrad. And so I feel like as I read Bell Hooks and a lot of contemporary feminists that I'm also digging kind of through the archives. It's unfortunate that we have to dig, right? But a lot of it has to do with these feminists not giving them much uptake, but they're there. And I'm glad she's bringing it to the forefront.
Now, one of the things, I was just listening to some of our first episode on race with Law. Does this stuff count as philosophy? Is it philosophical? She doesn't call herself a philosopher. She's professor of, I think, English, and she's in like women's studies departments and other stuff like that. She clearly reads just really widely. And in some ways, I don't know if she has an essay on this in particular, I think would just find the whole, is it philosophy? Like that's part of the problem, that these kind of hierarchical, just the rejection of, you know, unless you have qualifications or you're have a certain label, then we're not going to listen to you. Like that just seems entirely counter to what you would care about. But I think we can also see, so we've just done one on Adorno and then on Bourdieu, on these social theorists talking about class and stuff that's descended from Marxism. And Bell Hooks fits very much into that category too.
With some twists.
Dylan kind of pointed out earlier sort of the difference, and you mentioned the chronological difference between Ain't I a Woman and the essays we read. And Ain't I a Woman reads a lot more like an undergraduate version of Foucault.
Yeah. Did you thought of Foucault when you read it?
Totally, I did. Yeah.
Yes.
She quotes him at some point. I don't remember in what.
Yeah,
she mentions him later on in the theory.
Okay.
But my point being that I wish I wrote that well when I was 19, but... she's telling a story about a hidden and forgotten narrative. And one of the things that she does really, really well in that essay is point out how language is used to reinforce ideology and dominant paradigm without being obvious about it. It's a brilliant job of saying, here, you see how they use the word men or they use the word woman, but what they really mean is white women, black men, that sort of thing. And it, you read the quotes and then she makes that point and you go back and reread the quote she's referencing and you're like, oh my God, yeah. Whereas in the later essays, 20 years later, it's clear she's been in a critical theory department. She uses the term deconstruction. There's a lot of language that skirts, but without being obnoxiously so, my opinion.
Well, mostly in quotes. All the really obnoxious stuff is like she's quoting somebody else, if it really has that critical theory heavy vocabulary.
Yeah, she sort of hints and skirts around the vocabulary without turning the whole thing into just a jargon-laden thing. So it's there's an evolution there that I thought was really interesting.
I think different books are aimed at different audiences, but for the most part, and certainly both the books that we read are supposed to be accessible as widely as possible, that she would never want to, you know, say that this can be read by somebody with the appropriate graduate degree or something like that. It's not going to, so she's going to have a style that follows that. It's supposed to be consciousness raising for regular people.
So, Maisha, have you taught Bell Hooks classes or used her in any of your classes that you've put together?
You know what? Now that I think about it, I have never used Hooks before. That's pretty selfish of me. Now I feel bad.
But it sounds like if not using her essays, you've used her thinking about the role of, I guess, teaching to transgress, which I ordered, but I have not read yet.
Oh, man. Yeah. I think there's about 3 books in that series.
Okay.
Yeah, so I've benefited from her work in that. I'm calling it a book series. I don't even know if she referred to it as such, but I've learned a lot from that book series. And like I said, her work on masculinity and Black Rage is something that I've incorporated in my research, but I have never taught it, which is going to make me rethink some things when I teach a class this summer. But also, I must say that I've also never taught a feminism class. And for sure, if I was teaching that, I would most definitely include Bell Hooks in that. But yeah.
Hey, before I launch into a whole new topic on media critique, let's talk about our sponsor. We're going to bring in Wes to tell us about St. John's, and then also our friend Brian Wilson to tell us what's going on in Not School right now.
This episode of the Partially Examined Life is brought to you by the St. John's College Graduate Institute. The Graduate Institute is the master's degree granting arm of St. John's College in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and Annapolis, Maryland. Most of you listening are dedicated to the thoughtful reading of and serious conversation about the greatest books ever written. The Graduate Institute attracts a community of fellows who are passionate about the life of the mind. All classes at the St. John's Graduate Institute are, like PEL episodes, discussions. The books of the teachers and the faculty members are tutors who come together to learn as well. The Graduate Institute accepts applications on a rolling basis. There's no application fee, and the only requirement is a bachelor's degree in any field. In addition to degree-granting programs, the Graduate Institute at St. John's College sponsors summer educational opportunities, including a 9-week Ancient Greek Institute, an 8-week film studies program, and 2-week-long Science Institute programs. So, if you're a PEL citizen, fan, or even a casual listener with an interest in joining other like-minded individuals in a more formal, intimate setting to engage in a serious contemplation of great works of literature, philosophy, history, theology, mathematics, and science, check out the St. John's College Graduate Institute. For more information, visit partiallyexaminedlife.com/SJCGI. That's partiallyexaminedlife.com/SJCGI. Thanks to St. John's College Graduate Institute for their support of the Partially Examined Life.
Hi, all. Brian Wilson here with an update on our Not School program. We had 2 great kickoff seminars for you German philosophy lovers this past weekend. Justin Madra kicked off part 1 of Nietzsche's Thus Spoke Zarathustra, discussing the ideas of a new morality and the Übermensch as an ideal of self-mastery. Also this Sunday, Preston Price kicked off Hegel's Science of Logic. Be on the lookout for follow-up seminars from Preston and Justin in our Not School forums. Coming up May 15th, your humble narrator is leading a seminar on Descartes' Meditations on First Philosophy. We'll be digging into Descartes' thoughts on the concept of doubt, the mind-body relationship, and the existence of God. So basically a rehash of season 4 of The Real Housewives of Atlanta, but still good stuff in there. 2 more seminars that are still in the works are Mary Ricci's proposal looking at the 2016 U.S. presidential election position papers, and Michael Murray's Film as Art, looking at the great works of cinema and how they stand up as works of art. But don't like any of these options? It's not too late to propose your own group. Just go to the Citizens Forum and post your idea. To register for any of these seminars or organize your own, you simply have to become a PEL citizen, meaning pay $5 a month. And of course, it also includes the full-length, ad-free versions of the entire PEL podcast back catalog. If you have questions, you can reach out to me at brian@partiallyexaminedlife.com. Hope to see you at a seminar soon.
So the way that we stumbled on the Black Looks book was actually, so in our last episode on Bourdieu, Tim Quirk mentioned that, you know, he was given that Bourdieu book and also this White Privilege, which is a collection. And that actually has one of the essays from here in it, Representations of Whiteness in Black Imagination. That's chapter 11, which got me then looking at the rest of this book and seeing like, oh, okay, this is the hardcore. And I feel like this is a great way into a discourse that's very common now, but not as well done in the popular culture. Kind of like what you would expect, that this is sort of how I always think about religion, that you could really read the core religious texts or the great scholars within the tradition. And like, those will make sense. And you'll say, okay, I get where you're coming from. But then you'll just hear regular people. I don't know what that means. Like people that are not the genius writers talking about them, and it'll just sound like absolute garbage. But then when you sort of go back to see what they're bastardizing, then like, oh, okay, I see where that's coming from. And so in particular, the focus of Black Looks is just about media portrayal. And this is one of the kind of things that's very commonly discussed, and I think often causes a lot of eye rolling. Am I wrong about this? Which even the way she does it, the thing that I had sent you, which I'll share the description of, I was actually listening to in the car with my daughter. And it happened to get on the part where it was talking about the movie Frozen. So she was giving a critique of how little girls like the Elsa character, who's more white, who has white hair, who displays classical themes of domination in the way she ignores the pleas of her sister for attention, than Anna, who has darker hair and sort of represents this feminist spirit and sort of is somebody that they should more admire. But nonetheless, the little kids, they flock to the Elsa doll. And so my daughter was just confused by that. She's a big fan of Frozen. And then I tried to describe this to my wife, and she just like, I didn't portray it very well. And she just was very just like, this is why people stop listening to this stuff. Because if you're doing that kind of critique of that kind of movie in that way, like, what really, what are you trying to say? But I don't know, the way, the context that she was giving, you know, as we see in the introduction to Black Looks here, made the whole thing make sense to me. That if a lot of the issues, the persistent historical issues, are these stories we tell about ourselves, is our aesthetics, then yeah, according to her claim, the prime way, maybe her symptom of this, and maybe the main way of addressing it, is to have more control over images, to be able to have more control over the way different groups are depicted in the media. And that every time that there's something that is a stereotype or whatever, it's not just a matter of, oh, this quirky character in this sitcom. It's like just another reinforcement of the imperialist patriarchy. It's a sign that whether it was made by white people or by, according to her, you know, self-loathing black people that have internalized this. What did y'all think of that?
Yeah, I mean, I believe that representation matters. And people who believe that it doesn't, in some ways, either I think they're just blind or they've been privy to seeing images that represent them till it's kind of like just a norm, mm-hmm. right? Prior to our telephone conversation, I was listening to a geek podcast that I've listened to that I'm not going to say. And it's a movie coming out, and I forgot the movie. I think it's based on a Japanese anime character. And there's a movie coming out, and I'm not really good with actress's name, but a mainstream white actress is going to play the role. And the whole question of the podcast segment is this whitewashing, you know, the movie, and is it anything problematic with that? And one person said, yes, it was. The other person says, well, this is going to sell movies, right? Without this white actress being part of the movie, that's what's going to sell. And I think we've seen that. I mean, there's been several roles Hey, Nina Simone.
Yeah.
So the movie, even with Nina Simone,
yes,
being played by a black actress, but a black actress who doesn't really look like Nina Simone, right? And people are up in arms about that. And particularly for Nina Simone, representation mattered to her, mm-hmm. right? Just black and gritty, right? I mean, we've seen studies of young black kids having negative perspectives about other black kids through the Doll Project, right? And you got to ask yourself, well, why do they feel like that? Why do they think that the black doll is ugly? Well, because they've seen media kind of portray that Black people are ugly, Black people are thieves, Black people are violent. So kind of this self-hatred, and that has all come through representation. So I think representation does indeed matter. And even as I was reading this essay, I mean, I couldn't help but think about today. It's still an issue, right? This notion of, I don't know how many of y'all have heard the term of colorism. And bell hooks talk about this situation when she goes to another island and she's talking to her friend's daughter, and her friend's daughter kind of basically hates her skin and wants to become lighter, right? You have in other parts of the world in which people do believe that lighter skin is best. And so people are even bleaching their Black skin to become lighter, right? And this all has to do kind of with the images and this myth that whiteness is beautiful and whiteness is the best thing that one ought to be. And so one ought to try to be like that.
There's the practical issue that you're talking about, like the particular instances. And then there's this issue of the effects of media. And she says at the end of the introduction of Black Looks, she says many audiences in the United States resist the idea that images have ideological content. So there's that question of what it means, why people would either claim and push and emphasize that images and media have ideological content that affects things, and why would they resist it? And the context I've usually heard that in is in popular culture would be with music or books. And it's typically liberals who will say, look, what you say and the effect of the media is not what's at issue, that you need to be able to say whatever. There's like a freedom of saying things because it's assumed that you can be independent of that in your culture. It makes me think of Socrates in the Republic saying we ought to regulate what the poets say because it's bad for people to be taught the wrong things because it corrupts their souls. And there's something in common with that idea that what the media says matters, because when you're a student, you would resist this idea that there should be any kind of censorship. But there's other ways of talking about, without talking about censorship, but talking about just the effect of the way we speak and of media and images and poetry on how we think of ourselves and the way in which that's used both as a purposeful force, but also when you're steeped in it, that it also has an effect on you.
And I guess the source of resistance with all of this is that people don't like to consider themselves as being manipulated and subject to things. So if you ask explicitly the question of anybody that's reasonable, do you think, you know, whiteness is more beautiful than blackness or is better morally or something? You know, no. I mean, in the 21st century, if you're educated at all, you're not going to say that. And this is, you know, why people say, oh, racism doesn't exist anymore. The way that bell hooks puts it, well, she's talking about feminism mostly, but that it's at a point of crisis, that because certain advances have been made, I mean, whether it's women got the right to vote and now women are in positions of power and minorities are in positions of power and minorities are present on, you know, sort of every time there's advances, then, you know, there are a number of people that say, okay, either we've achieved or they've achieved. The goal has been achieved. And so people like bell hooks, they want us to engage in consciousness raising to realize that no, the problem is still deeper than that, that you are more messed up than you realize, whatever you may logically assent to. I guess, you know, one could see this as just part and parcel with Socrates' command to examine yourself. Can you at least be open to the idea that whatever your position is, no matter how liberal you may think you are, even if you are yourself a civil rights leader, there might be still something that is not properly decolonized.
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking about Marx here, and Marx didn't say this, but if I could, ideology is a hell of a drug. In some ways, believing it gives you a sense of comfort. And in other ways, in believing it, I mean, it totally is a danger to your own self-actualization. And so, of course, Marx doesn't highlight ways in which we can get over it. But, you know, it's a hell of a drug. And the question is, what do we do with it? I think that's the ethical question. What do we do? Do we resist it? Do we decolonize it? Decolonize our own thinking? Or do we continue to allow it to have its way? I think that's a challenge for us.
So can we talk about that term that I just threw around and you repeated that? Because she just kind of brings it up as well. Does that come from Frantz Fanon and people like that, that it's not the way that
decolonized?
Yes, that the way that bell hooks puts it somewhere in here is, you know, most people think that racism is a matter of race hatred, and they think, oh, you know, I don't have any explicit race hatred, so therefore that's fine. Or if you are a black person, no, of course I don't have any hatred toward black people, so what is the problem? Get off my back. No, because you're still, there's a colonial mindset here. What exactly goes into that? I'm not really familiar with the literature that is behind that.
I guess this is directed toward Maisha, unless somebody else knows.
Oh, it's directed toward me. Okay.
Everything is directed toward everyone.
I can't answer that question.
I'm an analytic philosopher. I can't answer that question.
Dylan's a physics guy. He can't answer anything.
Ouch.
I'm kidding.
Decolonizing is several parts to it, right? In one way, it's exposing the truth of the narrative. And so, for example, you know, in our textbooks, we learn that the Europeans came over and had a wonderful feast with the Native Americans and everything was peachy cream, right? And the decolonizing process exposes the truth of that encounter, right? So it exposes the messiness of imperialism, the messiness of sexism and racism. And then in other ways, decolonizing is, you know, trying to do surgery on ourselves. I mean, you know, you think about when the imperialists come over or the colonizer comes over, colonize a particular land, they give the natives a different kind of education, mm-hmm. right? A different way of living and being that totally takes away their true identity. And so when the colonizer leaves, you still have the problem of that mindset and that education. You know, how do you set yourself free? How do you become yourself again? How do you begin to think like yourself again without thinking with the lens of whiteness? Yeah, that's what decolonization is. And I think it's much more than that, but that's...
Well, I guess that's what I thought, that it's based on the metaphor of colonization, but especially when she talks about it, you know, as part of sexism. Like, really? Men colonize? Like, there's obviously no historical event by which men colonized women and... But there's still exactly what you're saying, that, you know, the dominant narrative was constructed by men with their own opportunistic self-interest in mind. That's a favorite phrase of bell hooks's here. Opportunistic self-interest that jumps in. No matter how well-intentioned, you know, you're trying to just tell a story. You're trying to, but you end up lionizing your own group, whatever that might be. And so decolonizing would be removing the effects of that. And that would be an issue even if you are among the group that is a colonizer group. Or is that right?
Yeah, I think it is, but it seems complicated in that the decolonization would not be just recovering oneself, would not be just going backwards, because you couldn't get rid of the effects of the colonization. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so decolonization would have to be, rather than a kind of surgical removal, it's a different kind of freeing that has to in some ways go through a colonized, thinking of having been colonized, in, let's say, in your mind or in your soul. Decolonizing isn't removing that. It's getting beyond it so that the effects of that colonization aren't guiding your soul anymore. And it would be true for both the oppressed and the oppressor as well. She talks about that some in the book. I mean, for obvious reasons, it does seem a little bit weird to talk about how bad the oppressor feels. And, you know, and gosh, they have some work to do too, you know, to free themselves.
She rejects that.
Well, she does say that being an oppressor is being a victim.
Yes.
And she, yeah. You know, just fair enough. Then she goes back to doing what she was doing.
She doesn't completely reject it, Seth.
What?
Yeah, I think my opinion, you're talking about that section where she says, if you take that tack, that's a strategy that, is that chapter 11?
Well, it comes up in a couple different places.
Anyway, she talks about the strategy of groups that try to recognize that everybody is victimized by the structure and use that as a strategy to say, hey, do you realize, even though as a white male, you benefit from everything that's happening and you really have no incentive to alter the power structure, you're actually being harmed by this. She says that that's a terrible, she didn't say terrible. She says that's not what she wants to do. And that's not what she thinks is an effective strategy for getting around that.
And is it a tactical matter that you shouldn't be doing that because that's not sort of the right reason to change, changing out of self-interest? I know she says that as a ready way that groups that have power will then deflect attention from the real problem by saying, well, we have problems too.
Yes.
So that she talks about this in Ain't I Woman at length, that when women, by which it meant white women in the women's movement, would compare their situation to blacks, by which it meant black men. That's sort of the problem she's pointing out throughout the book, as these sort of implicit references that leave black women not identified at all, invisible. But in any case, by making that comparison, it's really no, white women who just aren't allowed to have as good jobs as your husbands and aren't allowed to have money. Your situation, even though there are certainly problems with it, is nowhere near as horrible as anything that people went through in slavery. And so you making that comparison, there's a nice quote she attributes to Ortega y Gasset, another guy that Bourdieu quoted as well. It seems we need to move and read some of him soon.
Where is it?
Yeah, I have a quote. Yeah. This is page 13, Loving Blackness as Political Resistance.
Is this a quote from Bell Hooks or from Ortega y Gasset?
This is Bell Hooks. Many Unlearning Racism workshops focus on helping white individuals to see that they too are wounded by racism and as a consequence have something to gain from participating in anti-racist struggle. While in some ways true, a construction of political solidarity that is rooted in a narrative of shared victimization not only acts to recenter whites, it risks obscuring the particular ways racist domination impacts on the lives of marginalized groups. Implicit in the assumption that even those who are privileged via racist hierarchy suffer is the notion that it is only when those in power get in touch with how they too are victimized that they will rebel against structures of domination. The truth is that many folks benefit greatly from dominating others and are not suffering wound that is in any way similar to the condition of the exploited and oppressed.
Well, let me add to that the quote by Ortega y Gasset, which is at the bottom of page 141 of Ain't I a Woman, which is talking about, again, the comparison of women's issues with black issues, at least at the time before either of these groups could vote. A strange thing indeed, the existence in many of this mental activity, which substitutes one thing for another, from an urge not so much to get at the first as to get rid of the second. The metaphor disposes of an object by having it masquerade as something else. Such a procedure would make no sense if we did not discern beneath it an instinctive avoidance of certain realities. So you might think that you're highlighting the struggle of women by saying they're treated like black people were treated. But no, what that really does is just make you forget about how horrible black people were treated, according to Bell Hooks here.
Well, the passage that I was referring to is outside of the comparison context. And is, I don't want to say it's a minor point, but it's just a point that she makes. And this is on 114, the Imperialism of Patriarchy chapter. And she just simply explains, she says, this is the second sentence of the first full paragraph. Unfortunately, our overemphasis on the male as oppressor often obscures the fact that men are victimized. To be an oppressor is dehumanizing and anti-human in nature, as it is to be a victim. Patriarchy forces fathers to act as monsters, encourages husbands and lovers to be racist in disguise. It teaches our blood brothers to feel ashamed that they care for us and denies all men the emotional life that would act as a humanizing, self-affirming force in their lives. And then she continues a couple of more paragraphs. So she's just highlighting. I mean, she continues to make her point, but she just highlights, takes it aside to say, let's not forget, and this is outside the comparison context, let us not forget that the oppressor and oppressing us is also a victim, because in doing that, he or she dehumanizes their own selves. And it's just a separate point. Yeah.
No, that's totally valid. And it's consistent with the idea that the system itself victimizes everybody. But the reality is, you know, like it says in Animal Farm, right? All animals are equal, but some are more equal than others.
Yeah.
People are victimized in different ways. And there are people that benefit from the structure. I mean, everybody's victimized, but some people benefit. I think that's kind of the point, is that it's a theoretical move to say, hey, everybody's a victim. But in practice, we have to acknowledge the fact that some people stand to gain, and they have no incentive to overthrow the system that benefits them when the way they are victimized is really not that painful, or not acknowledged, or not painful enough to be acknowledged. If you piece all of her points together from the essays that we read, Ain't I a Woman, that her thesis is that decolonization may take place at an individual level first in terms of an awareness. Like, for example, I'm not a racist, but I benefit from the colonial capitalist racist structure that exists. Okay, that's one level of awareness. But to be fully decolonized, particularly as somebody who's oppressed by the system itself is going to have to be overthrown. I can't imagine, and I didn't see any examples of her describing or even suggesting, you could be fully decolonized and self-actualized and still function within the system. This ties back to our previous discussions around the culture industry and thinking about all those lessons of, if you're outside the system, you have to get appropriated inside the system, and the quirky outsider, and that there's very few narratives of people who successfully resist the system and end up living happily ever after. And that's because ideology expresses itself through those forms of culture, and they're telling us that story, like Brazil as a movie. And that's an old reference, I know, but it's the only one I've got on my hand besides Paul Newman in HUD. So I'm going to maintain throughout the rest of this evening, unless you convince me otherwise, that decolonization requires a revolutionary action that overthrows colonial capitalism such as it is right now.
Well, it certainly requires political action on her part. Are you saying something different than decolonization isn't a psychological stance where you can internally free yourself but go on your merry way? It inevitably and deeply involves outward action in your community specifically political action and activism. It seems like for her, the activism and the political action that she promotes is not like her duty. Like, you should go out and do this because it will help people. It's part of being the act of decolonizing oneself. It's not for decolonizing your community. It may be for partly for that, but it's also part of decolonizing yourself.
My reading of this is that she's saying you can't self-emancipate. It's not a religious or an intellectual exercise. It includes those. It includes at least intellectual elements. And by the way, the complete absence of discussion of religion in these works, I thought, was striking, particularly given our conversations around race in America and other contexts.
And also the role of religion in sexism.
Yes. And imperialism.
Oh, and racism,
and colonialism.
Too.
Colonialism. Yes, everything. Yeah. In one of the essays, she mentions how there's this need to create narratives so that Black women can see stories about a variety of different Black female experiences so that they can begin to have role models and have examples and opportunities, recognize that expression is okay. There's a lot of functions that happen there. Already, the fact that she's saying that we need this narrative structure, which is really about, you know, learning and growth, is suggesting that emancipation, if you will, or decolonization is not strictly a theoretical act that takes place in the individual. It's a social act because you have to see that played out in other people's lives, and then you emulate it to some degree or another, and then you share that with others. It's a process that involves other people. It's active. It's a practice.
Well, she thinks that no matter how sort of enlightened and free you think you are, unless you connect your struggle to a historical tradition of liberation, then you're missing something. You're at least reinventing the wheel, etc. You're going to fall into a lot of these traps. She says that a few times. That's kind of one of the points of the essay 3 in Black Looks, Revolutionary Black Women Making Ourselves Subject. So I'd pick that out of that whole volume as giving a little more of the positive picture. You know, the goal is Black female subjectivity. What does that mean? Well, it means that if you are colonized and you're in a minority group, then you see yourself as the other. It's some weird form of psychological dissociation. The perspective that you're trying to come from that has invaded your mind is not something that actually lines up with your own interests, much like anyone who's poor voting for the Republican Party. Oh, no, I can't make a comparison. That will obscure the thing that I'm talking about. Sorry. So what did you think about this subjectivity as the goal? So that requires, like you were saying, something that is social, which I guess follows straight up from Hegel. Nobody remembers that far back.
What, that Hegel talked about subjectivity? I remember that much.
And that requires an intersubjective communique. In fact, his model is of the master-slave, and it's only the slave that attains true understanding of him or herself, that attains true selfhood, because the master never gets that sort of outside perspective on himself. It's the slave that, because of having, you know, this domination attempt, then gains self-reflection because he already has the view of the other making him other. So you can say that these, and again, we'll do Franz Fanon, we'll do a Black existentialist who will fill in these details here, but I'm trying to do it myself because bell hooks doesn't use this kind of language. But that being in that position and then having to wrench yourself out of that gives you, well, that doesn't fill in the story of bell hooks as saying you need someone else for you to liberate. That's almost just saying you need an oppressor, an other in the first place in order to gain selfhood, which doesn't seem right according to bell hooks. Did I just make a confusing mess of things? Is that that's all I did there?
You made a little bit of a confusing mess, but
yeah,
the last thing you said started making sense because one of the themes that came out to me was this refusal, like in that triplet of patriarchy, imperialism, and capitalism. And I guess you would include other ones in there, other isms in there, is the whole role of domination in all of those cases where the motive action in each of them was one group in one way or another. Ruling would be the nice term, right? Oppressing another for their advantage and often convincing them that it was for their good. And her rejecting in the big picture, just wanting to reject that way of doing things at all. I mean, that's in some ways the more radical part of what she's saying is that replacing it. I mean, this is where the question of we get a tiny bit of it in this essay, Loving Blackness. But then Misha, you refer to other books that she's written about the answer being love. And that would run counter to this notion of competition or winning mm-hmm. or establishing structures in which to regulate competition so that it could be fair. I mean, even the whole idea of liberal democracy being structured in such a way that you would just try to make it so people kill each other less. But still, it's a structure of trying to mitigate some of the effects of domination. But it just takes for granted that that's the whole structure of activity, is one of interactions oriented towards domination. And she, I think, wants to just reject that outright. In a deeper way, she thinks that's the mistake being made.
Love is the answer. Here you go. Well, that sounds like a good place to wrap up our first half. So people can come back next week and hear the second half. Or if you're a Partially Examined Life citizen or want to just go to partiallyexaminedlife.com and become one, that just means making a small donation that is theoretically recurring, although you could really cancel it right now, then you'll get part two right now. So you get the citizen edition, which is the full unbroken ad-free thing. You don't have to let your anticipation be dominate your consciousness for the next week. You can just do it now. So see you then.
Thank you again to our sponsor, Libertarianism.org. Libertarianism.org has hundreds of informative resources to learn about the theories, histories, and principles of free societies. There are podcasts, videos, free books, classic reprints, and insights from experts past and present. Learn more about free and open societies at Libertarianism.org.